So this morning we're considering together Hebrews chapter 10, verses 26 to 39. So a cliche which football managers often use in their post-match interviews is this: it was a game of two halves. Now, of course, every game is, strictly speaking, a game of two halves, but what they mean when they say that is that it was a game of two quite different halves. So in the first 45 minutes, one team was in the ascendancy, and then following the halftime break, the other team was in the ascendancy. That's what they mean. And by the same token then, our passage this morning is a passage of two halves. Again, not just in terms of its structure. I mean, you can see immediately that it does consist of two similarly sized paragraphs, but in the sense that it consists of two quite different halves. Now, at the level of underlying theme, actually the two paragraphs aren't really all that different, but certainly at the level of mood, at the level of tone, there's a marked dissimilarity. As you move from verse 31 to verse 32, it does feel like you're entering different terrain. And so this morning then, let's consider together these two contrasting paragraphs under two headings. And first of all, an alarming assertion. An alarming assertion. And this is verses 26 to 31, the first of the two paragraphs. Because at the heart of this paragraph then lies an assertion which we may paraphrase like this: apostasy leads to devastating divine judgment. Apostasy leads to devastating divine judgment. Because when our writer begins then in verse 26, if we go on sinning deliberately after receiving the knowledge of the truth, apostasy is what he's referring to. We talked at some length about this before when we were in chapter 9 and verse 7 and looking at that phrase, unintentional sins. So I'm not going to labor this point this morning. But suffice to say that sinning deliberately, that phrase we have here, sinning deliberately, it's more than simply sinning consciously. Sinning knowing that we are sinning. Sinning in a situation where we could refrain from sinning, but don't refrain from it. I mean, we're all guilty of that, aren't we? That's where we've all been this past week. I mean, we've all sinned consciously. We've all sinned knowing that we were sinning at times. We've all sinned in situations where we could have refrained from sinning, but that's not what he has in mind in that phrase there in verse 26. He has in mind apostasy. That is to say, decisive rejection of Christ and the gospel. That's what he means by that phrase, sinning deliberately or sinning high-handedly, is the Old Testament equivalent that he's alluding to. It's in Numbers 15. The decisive rejection of Christianity's truth and necessity. I'm done with Christ and the gospel. That's the attitude that I mean by apostasy, and that's what our writer has in mind here. And he says then that awaiting such a person, awaiting the apostate, is judgment. Judgment which he elaborates with that terrifying phrase, a fury of fire. Now think about that then. Here's this person. And okay, this person has ultimately turned his back on Christianity. But for some time prior to that, perhaps over a period of many years, this person was a professing believer. This person was an involved member of a Christian church. And you might think, well, at the end of the day, surely that must count for something. Surely that must secure a degree, at least, of preferential treatment on that last day. Surely that must mitigate God's displeasure, the fact that this person's life wasn't devoid of Christian experience. He did have a stint of being an active Christian somewhere at some point in his life. We might think like that, but our writer says no. There's no preferential treatment for the person who lived as a Christian for a while but then turned away. There's no mitigation of God's displeasure on that basis. That person won't be accorded some in-between status between being God's friend and being God's enemy. No, that person will be regarded as an out-and-out adversary. That's the word our writer uses in verse 27. And that person will be subjected then to devastating divine judgment. So it raises the question then, why? Why is there no mercy for the apostate? Well, I think we can detect at least four reasons in this paragraph. Reason number one, the rejection of sacrifice. The rejection of sacrifice. So verse 26 then, if we go on sinning deliberately after receiving the knowledge of the truth, and I've just said that's talking about apostasy, then this, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins. We just sang a few minutes ago, I bring my sins to thee, the sins I cannot count, that all may cleansed be in thy once opened fount. And we could sing those words every day of our Christian lives, couldn't we? We constantly sin, and we constantly go back again to that once opened fount, the cross of Jesus, or in the language of our text, the sacrifice for sins. We participate in a gossipy conversation, and we defame somebody behind their back. And so we go back to the sacrifice for sins. We selfishly refuse help to someone we should be helping. And so we go back to the sacrifice for sins. We are lazy and accept payment for work that we haven't really done. And so we go back to the sacrifice for sins. We allow lewd thoughts to lodge and fester in our minds, and so we go back to the sacrifice for sins. We become covetously absorbed with the pursuit of possessions or status, and so we go back to the sacrifice for sins, and so we could go on. And on each occasion then, it works, and we are cleansed from that sin that we have committed. But you see, when the sin isn't gossip or selfishness or withholding help, when the sin isn't receiving undeserved payment or lewdness or covetousness, when the sin is actually rejecting the sacrifice for sins, turning one's back on the cross of Jesus Christ, when the sin is rejecting the sacrifice for sins, then by definition, there's no sacrifice for sins to which we can go and be cleansed from that sin. We use that phrase sometimes, don't we? Burning your bridges. So it's when you destroy your only means of escape or deliverance. And you know, we as Christians, we can commit some really serious sins. We can create an awful lot of damage and mess by committing those sins. But the bridge, the means of deliverance, the sacrifice of Jesus Christ on the cross of Calvary, it's still there for us. There's still a way back to God from the dark paths of sin. But the terrible thing about apostasy is that this sin is directed against the bridge itself. This sin is directed against the way back to God from the dark paths of sin. This sin doesn't launch its attack on God, like when we break the first four commandments. This sin doesn't launch its attack on human beings, like when we break the other six commandments. This sin launches its attack on the very solution to sin. the one and only solution to sin that there is, the gospel. This sin consists in taking a torch to the bridge and engulfing it. Its beams, its columns, its arches engulfing the bridge in flames. That's what our writer means when he says there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins. And so I beg all of you this morning who are professing Christians, whatever you do, don't commit this sin of apostasy. Don't commit this sin of abandoning your belief in the gospel of Jesus Christ, because once you have, where will you go to find atonement for that sin? You can't go for atonement to the sacrifice that you have rejected as a sacrifice for your sins. And so, why is there no mercy for the apostate? Reason number one, the apostate has rejected the one sacrifice for sins, the rejection of sacrifice. Reason number two, the precedent of Moses. The precedent of Moses, verse 28. Anyone who has set aside the law of Moses dies without mercy on the evidence of two or three witnesses. You see, there was an Old Testament form of apostasy. Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 2 to 9, envisages an Israelite basically changing his religion, exchanging the worship of Yahweh for the worship of other gods. And that seems to be the passage that our writer here has in mind, because he mentions the sentence of death. And he mentions the importance of the evidence of two or three witnesses. And both those details are there in Deuteronomy 17, verses 2 to 9. In other words, then, the revelation which God gave through Moses was so serious and so weighty that to turn one's back on that revelation warranted death. And of course, the logic of our writer here is obvious then, isn't it? You scarcely need a brain to be able to get what he's doing here. The revelation God has now given through his Son is more serious and more weighty. Therefore, turning one's back on that revelation cannot warrant a lesser punishment. On the contrary, he says, verse 29, how much worse punishment do you think will be deserved? Within the Old Testament law, apostasy was disastrous. Read the relevant legislation and you'll find that the idea of mercy is utterly absent when it comes to that sin. There was no chink of hope for the apostate. There was no crumb of comfort for the apostate. Apostasy was disastrous in the Old Testament. End of. And apostasy in a New Testament context then can hardly be less disastrous. This sin can hardly have been downgraded and de-escalated when now the coming of Christ and the cross of Calvary and the empty tomb is what the apostate is rejecting. If in the precedent provided by Moses there was no mercy, then self-evidently there can be no mercy when in these last days men and women fall away from the living God. So the rejection of sacrifice, the precedent of Moses. The third reason there's no mercy for the apostate, the nature of apostasy. The nature of apostasy. Imagine that a total stranger comes up to you one day and says to you, your house stinks. And your cooking is awful. And as for your conversation, it's the greatest cure I know for insomnia. I mean, you'd feel a bit insulted probably by that. You'd smart a little from those words. But then imagine an alternative scenario. That someone comes up to you who's not a total stranger. Someone who has actually stayed in your house and has received your hospitality, and that person says to you, your house stinks, and your cooking is awful, and your conversation is the greatest cure I know for insomnia. Well, that's way more insulting, isn't it? That will leave you far more aggrieved. In the first case, the comment is just ignorant and mindless. In the second case, that comment is taking the kindness and generosity which you have extended toward that person at some point, when you gave that person a bed and you provided food for them and you spent time talking with them. It's taking that kindness and generosity and throwing it back in your face. And verse 29 is saying that's what happens with apostasy. The apostate rejects God, having in a particularly extensive way benefited from God's kindness and generosity. This is ingratitude on the most monstrous and outrageous scale. That's what apostasy is. And so in verse 29 we have three descriptions of apostasy. Now, the middle one of the three is the one which most explicitly strikes this note that I'm talking about, where we read then that the apostate profanes the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified. So this person's connection then with Jesus' blood, of course, had never been substantial enough to be cleansed from guilt. If it had, then he could not have apostatized, because, of course, we know, don't we, from many places in the New Testament that a genuinely forgiven, guilt-cleansed person cannot fall away from the living God. But nonetheless, this person's connection with Jesus' blood, while not substantial enough then to have been cleansed from guilt, this person's connection with Jesus' blood was substantial enough for him to be sanctified, our writer says. That is, set apart from the world as a member of God's new covenant people. And this person then, in apostatizing, he's not rejecting something that he's ignorant about. He's not rejecting something that he stands completely on the outside of. No, he's rejecting something that he knows from the inside. Something which he himself has experienced to some degree, at least. He's throwing God's kindness and generosity back in his face. You go to the third description that we have of apostasy in verse 29. And this note that I'm talking about, this note of ingratitude, it's not quite as explicit there, but it is recognizable. The Holy Spirit is clearly who's in mind here. And he is then the Spirit of grace, I think, here, not merely in some kind of general absolute sense, unrelated to this apostate. No, I think the point is that the Spirit has been gracious to this person. This person has never experienced the Spirit's converting ministry, because again, if he had experienced the Spirit's converting ministry, he couldn't become an apostate. Again, the New Testament is quite clear on that. Conversion, genuine conversion, cannot be undone. But this person may have experienced the Spirit's gift-giving ministry. I talked about that many weeks ago now in relation to chapter 6 and verse 4, and I said it's supportable both from Scripture and I think from our general observation within the Church of Jesus Christ, that sometimes those whom the Spirit gifts in a particular way, perhaps preachers for instance, who are used in the lives of others, sometimes those people do turn out to be apostates who never were genuinely united to Jesus Christ, and yet they experience something of the Spirit's gift-giving ministry. And probably that's then the ministry of the Spirit which our writer has in mind here. And again then, this person is not rejecting something entirely alien to his own experience. No, he's rejecting something which to some degree he has tasted for himself. He is throwing God's kindness and generosity back in his face. And go to the first description of apostasy in verse 29. And it's the least explicit on this note of ingratitude. But I think in this case it's hinted actually in the verb. That verb in the ESV, spurned, the one who spurned the Son of God. It's literally in the Greek, trampled underfoot. We only have a few instances of this Greek word in the New Testament. And interestingly, one of those is Matthew 7, verse 6. You'll all be familiar with it. Jesus' proverbial advice not to throw pearls to pigs, lest they trample the pearls underfoot and then turn on you and attack you. So in that instance of the word, then you're giving these pigs something precious, pearls. And it's that, it's something precious that they are trampling underfoot. And similarly here then, God has given this person some knowledge of and connection to his son. Again, it can't be a fully saving connection to his son, otherwise the person could not have apostatized subsequently. But God has given this person some knowledge of and connection to his son. And that, of course, is supremely precious, more precious than pearls. But this person then has trampled that precious gift underfoot, thrown God's kindness and generosity back in his face. I'm saying then that's the nature of apostasy. It's an act of obscene ingratitude to God. When a person has been living for some time within the Christian community and enjoying exposure to the gospel and some participation in the Spirit, even if just the gifts of the Spirit are given to that person, it's spectacular boorishness when that person then just goes and abandons it all. Is it any wonder God has no mercy toward apostates? So the rejection of sacrifice, the precedent of Moses, the nature of apostasy, and then a fourth reason why there's no mercy for the apostate, the character of God. The character of God. Verses 30 to 31, we know him, he begins. We know what God is like, in other words. He said, vengeance is mine, I will repay. And again, the Lord will judge his people. And then he concludes, it is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. He's simply saying then God is a God who judges. Now the point is not then that God relishes the pursuit of vengeance. It's his favourite thing and he's in his element when he's doing that. Now we know, don't we, from so many other passages that God is also slow to anger and he's a God of stunning and instinctive and irrepressible grace. We know that. So as I say, the point is not that God just loves judgment and he relishes the pursuit of vengeance. That's certainly not the point. But the point is that he will pursue vengeance. He will. He's not this big, toothless, cuddly teddy bear figure who doesn't really have it in him to pursue vengeance so that you can apostatize with impunity. You can throw his kindness and generosity in his face. You can turn round and say to him, actually, God, after all these years, I can't now be bothered with your gospel anymore. I'm not going to be a Christian anymore. You can do that and you'll still be okay at the end of the day. No. With this God, you can't apostatize safely. That's the point our writer is making. This is the God who judges. And it's a fearful thing, he says, to fall into the hands of this God. So those then are the reasons why there's no mercy for the apostates. And it should sober all of us who are professing Christians this morning. Sometimes we need to be sobered by the word of God. And this passage, with this emphasis, should sober us all this morning. This alarming assertion that apostasy leads to devastating divine judgment, it should give us all real pause for thought, and it should make us resolve right now in our hearts that we will never go down this route. It should make us fear falling away from God like we fear nothing and no one else in all the world. It should make us cry out to God this morning, Lord, may this never be me. May this passage, this paragraph, never be a transcript of my life, a description of my career. May this never be said of me that Oh, he was a professing Christian for such and such a time, and then he apostatized. May we be sobered by this alarming assertion. So that's the first paragraph, an alarming assertion. But then the second paragraph is verses 32 to 39, and our second heading then, an appealing alternative. An appealing alternative. Because I said then that it's a passage of two halves, two quite different halves. Although I qualified that and said that kind of at the underlying level, really our writer, he's on the same theme, he's covering the same terrain. But certainly there is a difference in tone. We can put it this way, I think, that what the first paragraph does is this: it depicts apostasy in a highly negative light. What the second paragraph then does is this: it depicts the opposite of apostasy, which is endurance, in a highly positive light. So endurance is the appealing alternative to which my heading refers. And as our writer discusses endurance then in this paragraph, let's just notice three things. First of all, the possibility of endurance. The possibility of endurance. Because really then what he's doing in verses 32 to 34 is this. He's saying, look, you readers of mine, you first readers, you first century Christians to whom I'm writing, look, I know that you can endure. I know that you're going through difficult circumstances, and that's kind of hinted at various points in this letter. I know things aren't easy for you, but I know that despite all that, endurance is possible. And he knows that then not just for kind of pious theological reasons, because they have a God who can keep them and make sure that they endure, etc., etc. But no, he says much more basically, I know that you can endure because you've already endured in the past when you face difficult circumstances. You faced grievous trials in the past and you endured, you kept going. And that then clearly indicates to me, he's saying, that you can endure now and you can endure in the future and you can endure as long as you need to endure. So let's look in more detail at what he says here. He says, first of all, what they endured. And what they had endured then at this earlier point in their Christian lives, he says it was after you were enlightened, that means after you were converted, perhaps very early on, that seems to be what he's saying, very early on in their Christian lives. What did they endure? Well, three losses, the loss of dignity. Verse 33, you were sometimes publicly exposed to reproach and affliction. In other words, you were ashamed before others. You had shame heaped upon you. Before others, your dignity was taken away from you. The loss of dignity, then the loss of freedom, because, well, he says in verse 34, you had compassion on those in prison, which presumably implies that some of them themselves were in prison. So some of them were actually imprisoned for Christ's sake. Loss of dignity, the loss of freedom, and then the loss of possessions. You accepted the plundering of your property. That may well have gone with the imprisonment, that once they were in prison, a bit like in these hurricane-hit places in the States where there's looting going on because the houses have been abandoned. And similarly here, their houses have been abandoned because they've been put in prison. And while their houses were abandoned, others came along and looted their houses. That seems to be what's in view. So that's what they endured. We're not talking about just minor, low-key trials here. It was pretty serious stuff. The loss of dignity, the loss of freedom, and the loss of possessions. That's what they endured, how they endured. And they endured then with two conspicuous qualities. Quality number one, solidarity. He says at the end of verse 33, you were partners with those who were treated. And then verse 34, he amplifies that you had compassion on those in prison. This was a prominent feature of your endurance, This was one of the ways it manifested itself. You showed solidarity with your brothers and sisters who were also suffering, and in some cases were perhaps suffering more than you were suffering. And of course, there must be an intended contrast here, mustn't there, with the passage we were looking at last week, where now they don't even show sufficient solidarity to bother meeting with each other, some of them, on the Lord's Day. Now they're neglecting even to meet together. Back then, he says, you showed such solidarity that, well, it was, you had all this overflowing compassion on those who were in prison. When others were in prison, you went to them. Now you won't even go to them for a worship service on the Lord's Day. That's the point he's making. So solidarity, and then the other striking quality of their endurance, joy. You joyfully accepted the plundering of your property. So what they endured, how they endured, and then the third thing, why they endured. Why was it? End of verse 34. Since you knew that you yourselves had a better possession and an abiding one. Talking, of course, about their eternal future. I remember the 3rd of October 1995, walking away from York City's stadium, Bootham Crescent. We'd just knocked Manchester United out of the League Cup. And at one place, there were these people standing around. The police were there. And apparently, these were York City fans. And their car had just been stolen during the match. But the striking thing was, they didn't seem remotely bothered about this. They were laughing and didn't seem to mean much to them. They just enjoyed this great evening. Their team had won this great victory. And that's kind of what our writer has in mind here, that it was nothing to you. This loss of your possessions, your houses were looted while you were in prison, but you didn't bother you, didn't dent you, because you knew you had a better possession in that eternal future to come. And so he's saying then that I know you can endure. It's possible, because I remember when you endured in the past in the face of all of this. And just several applications there for us. Application number one, we should learn the lessons of our trials. We often say, don't we, that God never sends our trials for no purpose. Every trial has a purpose. And one of the purposes of our trials is so that in the future we'll be able to look back and say, well, I endured then. By God's grace, I can endure now. When I was a student at Bible college, I had a placement on the Isle of Lewis, and hadn't been preaching all that long, and I was having to preach in a fairly large congregation, 300 or 400 people, and if that wasn't bad enough, it seemed that this particular congregation was the one that attracted all the ministers in Scotland when they were on holiday. And this was in the summer, and so the place was just full of ministers. I kind of felt, well, after doing that, I could preach in pretty much any context, whoever walked in on a Sunday. And similarly then, when we've experienced a trial, it should fill us with that confidence that God has kept me this one, then I don't need to fear the next trial. A trial in a year's time, in 5 years' time, whenever it might be. Another lesson here is that endurance is closely connected to hope of the future. These people endured back then because they were looking forward to this better possession and an abiding one. And if we are going to be endurers, we need to have clear convictions about our eternal future. With little children, even with Fraser still, you can assume a lot. And so we go on a journey, and we're perhaps going on holiday or something, and we've been preparing for this for several days. And then it's only when we've been driving for about 4 hours that Fraser suddenly says, where are we going? And you realise, well, he doesn't actually have a clue what's going on here, and that we're going on holiday and all the rest of it. He's wondering why we're still sitting in the car. And similarly for us, we can just kind of plough on with our Christian lives at times without even thinking, where are we going? What's this all about? What's the goal here? Why are we Christians? The goal is this eternal future. And the more we realize that and think about that, the more we will be enabled to endure in the present. And then just one other lesson from this is that it's striking to me that the writer has to say in verse 32, recall those former days. And he has to kind of go through it in lots of detail. I mean, you'd have thought if these people had endured all this in the early days of their Christian lives and had triumphed over all these sufferings and all these trials, you'd have thought they would remember it pretty clearly. But it seems like perhaps they don't, and they need to be reminded of where they were at back then. And I think sometimes perhaps we would do well to stand back and ask the question, where was I at as a Christian 5 years ago, 10 years ago? Because we might just assume we're in the same place now as we were then, but in actual fact, when we stand back and compare, we might find that we've drifted. And we look back and we just look at what a day was for us, a day's routines, a day's structure, a week's routines, a week's structure back then for us as Christians. And we read the Bible each day and we prayed, oh, perhaps I'm not doing that so much anymore. And I was always there on a Sunday and at the midweek prayer meeting. Oh, well, I'm much more sporadic now than I was then. And I was helping these different people in the church back then, and now I don't seem to really have much contact with others in the church. And you see what I mean? That we can easily drift without even realise we've drifted. And that seems to be why the writer is saying, recall, recall. They don't think that anything's changed. And he's saying, things have changed. Back then you went to visit your brothers in prison, now you won't even spend the Lord's Day with them. And so it's a good thing for us to do sometimes, to step back and compare where we were then with where we are now. And hopefully we'll find that actually things are much better. But it's not necessarily so. The possibility of endurance. And then the necessity of endurance is the second emphasis here. We don't need to spend long on this. We've already covered this kind of ground in the letter, verses 35 and 36. Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward. You have need of endurance so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what is promised. And the simple point then is that you won't receive that eternal reward without endurance. He's really saying the same thing as he was saying in the first paragraph, but in a more positive way. He's saying that in the first paragraph, he was saying that if you don't endure, you'll receive the fires of hell. Now he's saying if you don't endure, you won't receive the rewards of heaven. That's what he's saying. He's saying that a 10-year period of being a professing believer, at some point in your life, that won't get you the eternal reward. We sing sometimes, he who dies believing dies safely through his love. Or in another hymn that instead of pointing us to death, points us to the very end itself. When he comes with trumpet sound, may I then in him be found. Not may I be found in him for a period at some stage in my life, but then when he comes, may I die believing. That's the important thing, that we finish the race enduring, because only then will we receive the reward. The possibility of endurance, the necessity of endurance, and then finally the dignity of endurance. The dignity of endurance. By which I mean this, it seems to me that in verses 36 and 37, our writer uses some language deliberately intended to refer us back to the start of the chapter. Notice in verses 5 to 7, our writer quotes from Psalm 40. And notice verse 7, I said, behold, I have come to do your will, O God. Now remember, this is Psalm 40 that's been quoted. It's a messianic psalm. Our writer is applying it to Jesus. That's Jesus coming into the world, and he says, I have come to do your will, O God. Here now in verse 36, when you've done the will of God, you may receive what is promised. Or similarly, jump back to verse 6. Again, Jesus speaking in burnt offerings and sin offerings, you have taken no pleasure. And we have that language again here in verse 38. My righteous one shall live by faith. If he shrinks back, my soul, this is God speaking, has no pleasure in him. And so we seem to have the language which at the start of the chapter was being used of Jesus and his mission and his career and his endurance. That language is now being used of the believer's endurance. The point being then that when we endure, we are being like Jesus Christ. And of course, he'll come back to this at the beginning of chapter 12. Jesus endured to the cross. We endure to our deaths or to the return of Christ, whichever comes first. And this is the dignity of endurance then, that it's being like Jesus. It's following in the footsteps of our dear master. It's a kind of glaring thing that we can easily overlook when we look at the life of Jesus. And we talk about emulating Jesus, don't we? And we want to emulate Jesus the way he treated his enemies. And we want to emulate Jesus the way he evangelized the Samaritan woman and the rich young ruler. We want to emulate Jesus the way he was so prayerful, morning by morning, and so on. But we can actually overlook the most glaring thing that the Gospels point to about Jesus. He kept going. He endured against temptation after temptation, obstacle after obstacle. He endured all the way to the death of the cross. And we then are never more Christ-like than when we're enduring, when we're keeping going. The Christ-like Christian is the one who can get to the end and say, I finished the race. I have fought the fight. I've kept the faith. May God help us all to endure. Amen.